Thank you. So, as Celine was saying, I'm going to tell you something about the hidden symmetries in cosmology and black holes, which is the work that I've done in Lyon during my PhD under the supervision of Marc Dreyer and Tatiana Levine. And so, but before starting to get into the details of symmetries and mini superspaces, I would like to give some motivation for why we should look at these mini superspace models, because I mean, as you all know, one of the main challenges for modern theoretical physics is to have a quantum theory for gravity. And there are some theories which are candidate to be the quantum theory for gravitation, but all of them are very complicated, and it's difficult sometimes to extract some physical information out of this theory. And as always in physics, when something is complicated, we try to simplify a little bit the problem. And one way of doing it in the case of gravity is to study some lower dimensional models, like two or three dimensional gravity. And this is interesting for the study of the boundary structure, for some entropy, for orography properties of gravity. And there is also another way of simplify the study of gravity, which consists in symmetry reduced model, which of course is the case that I'm gonna tell you about. And in this case, so the symmetry reduced model, we just take a subset of the solution of general relativity in the four dimensional case by imposing some symmetry, some additional condition on our space time. And this of course simplify a little bit the problem, but it's still interesting for some phenomenological aspects or even some fundamental aspect of classical and quantum gravity. The main tool that I will use is symmetries, which is present in the title of my talk, which, because symmetries, I mean, are one of maybe the most powerful tool in physics, in theoretical physics. We can distinguish the role of symmetries between gauge and physical symmetries, and they are more important in the classical and in the quantum theories. On the classical level, because they control the structure of the classical solution, but they also give a non-perturbative handle on quantization. In particular, in gravity, we have, symmetries play a very important role, because we have a huge group of symmetry at the very heart of gravity, which is the diffeomorphism, which is a gauge symmetry for gravity. And on top of this, we also have some additional structure. We have this boundary asymptotic symmetries, because when you add the boundary, we know that adding a boundary on the manifold that we study turns some symmetries from gauge to physical. But we also have something different. We have some algorithm that maps, for example, the non-rotating solution for a black hole into the rotating solution, which is known as Neumann-Jannings algorithm. So there are some symmetries in the structure of the solution of general relativity. And we also have some symmetries of the quasi-normal modes, the vanishing of the law of number, which measures the tidal response of a black hole. So there are, some additional structure which exists in gravity. And I will come to this quasi-normal mode and law of numbers by the end of my talk. So now the main character for my talk is mini superspaces, which consists in a very simple subset of solution of general relativity. Within this class, we have black holes and cosmology, so they are still, even if they are simple, they are nevertheless important because of the phenomenological importance of black holes and cosmology in gravity. And mini superspaces are defined as a solution where we can fix the evolution of the spacetime into three dimensions, so on a slice. So we freeze the evolution on a three-dimensional slice, and we focus on field that evolves just in the orthogonal direction. And I'll call this orthogonal direction by tau, and while x parametrize the homogeneous coordinate in which the evolution is frozen. So doing so, we will have just a finite number of degrees of freedom, because the field will evolve in just one direction. So the model that we describe the dynamics of this field will be a mechanical model and not a field theory, like in the case of the full field. As I was saying, within this class of mini superspaces, we have all the cosmological model according to the classification of Bianchi with respect to the group of isometries, two-dimensional group of isometries in the slice. And we also have the black holes by demanding that the slice is spherically symmetric. So they have a topology of a sphere times a radial direction. I just remarked that this spherically symmetric doesn't fall within the class of the Bianchi classification because the group of symmetry of this topology is four-dimensional. We have a three-dimensional, three isometries for the sphere and one for the radial direction. So the spherically symmetric slice doesn't fall within the class of the Bianchi classification. And I will use the example of black hole throughout my talk as an example of these mini superspaces symmetries. I forgot to say, if there are any questions at any time, don't hesitate to ask during my talk. So black hole mini superspace, it's defined by diesel an element here, where we have took this in this parameterized by these two fields V1 and V2, which depends on the orthogonal direction of the slice, which, as I was saying, parameterized by tau, and the slice is parameterized by this dx direction, which is the real line, and the omega is the element on the two sphere. And I just introduced this LS as a constant in order to have dimensionless fields. So once we have this element, we can calculate the Einstein Hilbert action for this element to evaluate the Ricci scalar or the four-dimensional metric times the terminal of the metric. And we obtain that once we integrate over the slice, we obtain just a mechanical model, as I was saying, because all the fields will depend just on time. So the integration over the slice can be carried on without problems. Just there is a problem because the x direction is non-compact in principle, because it's x is on the real line. So in order to have a finite integration over dx, we need to regulate it to be into a finite interval. And doing so, we can integrate this three-dimensional integration over the slice in order, and we obtain a fiducial volume for the slice, which is given just by this quantity here. Sorry. Laurent, you have a question? I see you.
Yes, Francesco. Can you tell us the motivation for this parametrization? I mean, you have a null parametrization of the metric, but
the motivation is just we come just in the end of the slice, which is this one, because once we calculate the equation of motion from this action and solve them, which is quite simple to do. We obtain the Schwarzschild solution in both the interior and the exterior, in the sense that once we evaluate the equation of motion, solve them, and put them into the Riemann elements at the beginning, we obtain that this is the Schwarzschild solution where tau is the radius and x is null direction, is the incoming null direction. So this is the Schwarzschild solution in the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinate, and the choice of this parametrization is to have in the same model both the interior and the exterior, because sometimes there are some problems in this mini superspace setup. In order, people do the interior or the exterior separately, but with this choice of parametrization for the elements, which we have both at the same time, because there is no horizon singularity. The matrix is regular throughout the singularity, throughout the horizon, sorry. That's why I choose this element here.
Okay.
But yes.
No, go finish.
Okay. Now the subtlety is that we have the mechanical model that we have describes the evolution of this field V1 and V2 in the radial direction. So this is not an usual Hamiltonian formalism, which you have the evolution parameter, which is time-like. In this case, it's space-like, but this is a subdot, because at the end of the day, we can the mechanical model is completely solvable, and we can solve it and obtain the right solution as expected from for a spherically symmetric static lane element, which is the Schwarzschild solution. And so you had a question?
Well, this length scale LS, it's completely arbitrary, or it's like the mass of the black hole, or?
No, it's completely arbitrary and will disappear. I mean, it disappears once. I mean, we just need to, I will come to the role of this LS in the following, but it's not directly related to the mass. It's just, it's completely arbitrary. And I mean, because it's somehow related to the fact that we have a two-dimensional configuration space, because we have two fields, V1 and V2, so a four-dimensional phase space at the end of the day. Well, we know that, I mean, the Schwarzschild solution is parameterized by just one physical parameter, which is the mass. So there are other first integral of the motion, which are somehow unphysical, but will play a role in the discussion of the symmetry of the model.
Okay, and maybe one last question on the motivation. Yeah. You don't mention that, but it looks like this is similar to the Bondi parametrization of asymptotically flat metrics. So is it that you're looking at a class of asymptotically flat metrics?
Not really, because I mean, as in what follows in the discussion of the symmetry, we'll see that the symmetry strongly depends on, I mean, will depend, all the charges of the symmetry will depend on this, I call it time, but it's not time, it's radius. So this parameter, this evolving parameter tau, which is the radius. So it's kind of the opposite of what you do in the Bondi asymptotic symmetry discussion, because you do an expansion in the radius, and the charge will evolve with respect to the null direction. Well, here the evolution with the null direction is fixed, and I discussed the evolution of the metric in the radial direction. So it's in some sense it's orthogonal to the discussion of the asymptotic here.
So just a question. So are you metric not asymptotically flat, or are they?
No, they are asymptotically flat. I mean, they are just one solution. My metric is
they are.
Of course they are. But I mean, there are some subtleties related to the usual discussion of asymptotically flat symmetries. The symmetries that I discuss are not directly related to the asymptotically flat symmetry, because of this exchange between the radial and the null direction. Okay. So we have this action, which is the second one for the black hole. And we can recognize that this action can be written in a more compact form, which if we write it as the action which describes the motion of a particle which moves on a curved space-time, which is parametrized by the coordinate v1 and v2. So what happens is that we describe the motion of the matrix, of the metric coefficient v1 and v2, in terms of a particle which moves on a field space, which is parametrized by the metric coefficient themselves, so v1 and v2. And this is something that is not specific to the black hole solution, but to the black hole mean superspace, sorry, but it's something that is quite general for all the mean superspaces. So all the mean superspace Lagrangian can be written as the combination of the velocities of the matrix, so of the velocities of the metric coefficient v1, v2, or maybe more fields if in a more general case, and the potential. And in order to understand this, we can see it by looking at the Hamiltonian formalism, because we know that from general relativity, the Hamiltonian formalism of general relativity is described by the ADM Hamiltonian. And once we impose the symmetry reduction, so we go, we evaluate this Hamiltonian for the mini superspace metric, it's obvious to obtain from the first term, which is the kinetical term, which contains the extrinsic curvature, so the variation of the metric in the orthogonal direction of the slice. This will just be given by a combination of the momenta of the fields V1, V2, and V3, if there is an extra field. And the potential will just come from the intrinsic curvature, which measure the curvature of the slice, which just depend on the metric coefficients. So in some sense, we have traced the study of the evolution of the metric in terms of space-time and Einstein equations with the motion of a particle which moves on a curved on a curved space-time, which is parameterized by the metric coefficient. So we, in some sense, we study the geometry of the geometry. It's a kind of second geometrization of dynamics, because this G alpha beta is not directly related to the space-time metric. It's just the way that this momentum P alpha and P beta combines once we do the symmetry reduction from the general ADM Hamiltonian. And of course, we need to choose a clock because of a clock in the sense that we need to fix this lapse function n in order to discuss the properties of this metric, because n acts as a conformal factor for this metric here. Yes, Bianca?
Capital G does depend on Q or not? I mean, I know some cases where it does not.
Capital
G?
G?
Yeah.
Well, the metric of course depends on Q. Yeah, if you look at the first line, you see that the way, I mean, for example, G11 would just be V0 V2 over V1 squared.
Okay. Well, sometimes you can make a variable transformation anyway. So Bianchi,
of course,
written in this way as a free particle. So you in Minkowski space. So there it doesn't anyway. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, you can do a coordinate transformation, and in some cases, you can obtain.
Okay.
A,
so
a constant.
So yeah. So little q is directly v.
Little q is directly v. Yes. Little q okay. is the coordinate on the field space. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So as I was saying, we trade the study of the evolution of the space-time metric with the geodesic motion on the field space, eventually, in the case of a non-constant potential, a geodesic motion under a certain potential. In this case, the potential is a constant, so we will have a real geodesic motion on the field space. And because of this, we know how to build conserved quantities along a geodesic motion. By the knowledge of the symmetries of the what I will call the supermetric, so the metric that, which measure the which appears in the Lagrangian, because if we have a Killing vector which preserves the metric, we know that the contraction of the Killing vector and the velocities along the geodesic will give a constant along the geodesic motion. And we also know that this can be generalized to conformal Killing vectors, so vector that preserve the metric up to a constant. And we also ask in a general case that the potential is preserved by the action of the Killing vector by a constant. And if we have a xi, that a vector xi that satisfies these properties, we know that we have a zero order charge, which is of course the Hamiltonian, which is conserved along the motion because it does depend on time. And we can build a first order charge in the sense that it is first order in this evolution parameter tau, which is given by just by the contraction of Xi and P, and a constant, I mean, a rescaling of the Hamiltonian, which, I mean, a linear term which takes into account the rescaling of the metric. And whenever the supermetric is flat, we know that from the norm of the Killing vector, so the scalar product from it, the scalar product of the vector with himself, we can build charges with that which are quadratic in time, which are given by the so the norm of the Killing vector, a linear term times the contraction of the vector and the momenta, and a quadratic terms times the Hamiltonian. And all these charges are conserved in the sense that they are weak, they are observable because they, I mean, they explicitly depend on time, but the total variation with respect to the time, time to this parameter tau, is zero. So the partial variation plus the bracket with the Hamiltonian is zero. And of course, in general, there might be more than one conformal Killing vector. So we can still be at the zero order charge as the Hamiltonian. The first order charge would just be the contraction with the momenta and the respect the lambda of each vector times the linear term, and the second order charge will be given by all the scalar products among the vectors. So this is the recipe is to obtain the symmetries, I mean the conserved charge for our mini superspace model, and we can apply it to black holes and to the cosmology, the Friedmann cosmology with a scalar field. In both cases, we find that there is an eight-dimensional algebra of observable, which form, which is what is called the Schrödinger algebra, which is the products of SL2R times an abelian rotation, and which act semi-directly on the Heisenberg algebra, two-dimensional Heisenberg algebra, which is just the usual Heisenberg algebra on a four-dimensional phase space. And as I would like to remark, the fact that the Schrödinger algebra is the group of symmetry of free particle in quantum mechanics is the group of symmetry of the Schrödinger equation in the free case, which is why it's called Schrödinger algebra. And it's also the dynamical symmetry, generates the dynamical symmetry of the compressible Navier-Stokes equation. And I will come to this also at the end of my talk. But so we have the symmetry. The problem is, what is the interpretation of the symmetry of this symmetry in the case of mini superspaces? And in order to understand this, I will start by the discussion of the cosmological case, because in this case, the SL2R symmetry was already known and was actually found and refound by many different peoples. And in the flat case, so we have a flat cosmology with a scalar field, and this SL2R symmetry is related to the scaling properties of the homogeneous volume and energy for the flat cosmological case. So it seems that this is something that is specific to cosmology, while we have found that it is not actually, because we have found that there is an SL2R symmetry also in the case of black holes. And it's even more powerful because actually what happens is that we can obtain this SL2R symmetry even in the full GR case. So we have a completely arbitrary metric, which still depends on the direction on the slice. So it's an homogeneous metric and it's extrinsic curvature. So we go back to the ABM description of gravity with a kinetical and a potential term. And if we calculate the time derivative of the volume, so the integral of the determinant of the induced metric, we find that this is always, the full theory, proportional to the Gibbons-Sokin term, which is nothing but the trace of the extrinsic curvature integrated over the slice. By Gibbons-Sokin term, I mean the term, the Gibbons-Sokin term on the initial and final slice, which are the one that are necessary to have a well-defined variational principle to go from Einstein-Hilbert to the ADM version of gravity. And what happens is that if the upper surface is flat, so we don't have this term here, just the Hamiltonian, which is just given by the theoretical term, then CV and H, so C is this extensive curvature, V is of course the volume, and H is the Hamiltonian, generate a symmetry for the evolution. So we can build conserved quantities up from this CV and H in the same way we build this zero order, the second order, and first order charge in the previous slide. So another question is, what happens if there is a curvature and we have an example at hand which the curvature is not vanishing, which is the black hole case, because we have a non-vanishing potential for the black holes. So we go back to the black hole, we have the charges at hand, which have this form here, which I've written in the CV and H kind of form. So we have the V2 field, which plays the role of the volume. We have this function C on the phase space, which is the generator of isotropic dilation on the phase space, and H tilde, which is the kinetical part of the Hamiltonian. And these are conserved because, I mean, we obtained this from the Killing vector of the supermetric, so we know that these are constant along the evolution. And I introduced this dimensionless parameter k as the ratio between the fiducial volume and the Planck length. So we have this charge, we can exponentiate them and obtain the finite version of the transformation, which we know by applying the Noether theorem, which are symmetries, because we have conserved charges and for mechanical models, so we can straightforwardly obtain the corresponding symmetry. And we see that they of course exponentiate into the SL2R group, which is parameterized by this Möbius transformation on this parameter tau, and acts as a conformal rescaling of this field V1 and V2. So this, I mean, is still some mathematical definition of the symmetry, but we still lack of the interpretation of the symmetry. And the way to obtain this interpretation is, yes, Bianca?
Sorry, so curly Ln? Should I understand it as a generator in phase space for the Poisson brackets?
Yes.
But it does depend on tau.
Yes.
So you had some explicit tau
transformation
dependence in your charges and your exponentiate actions. And how do you determine, how do you get the action on tau?
Yeah, actually, this is, thank you for the question. I mean, when you act on this, if you just exponentiate the action of this ln into the phase space variable, you cannot obtain the transformation of tau, just obtain this V transformation of V. But actually what you obtain is that this is this transformation here composed. I mean, this is the active way of seeing it, as opposed to the passive way, which is the one that you obtain by really exponentiating the action. So what you obtain by exponential reduction is that you obtain, if you call this function f, tau tilde is f, what you obtain is v of tau times this composed with f minus one. So this is just.
Yeah, so you're saying you have to deduce what tau tilde is.
Yeah, it's just a more, I mean, yeah, it's an equivalent for way of formulating the, of writing the symmetry, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just an equivalent way. It's just that, yeah, instead of putting all the symmetry into the transformation of the field, I put it also in the transformation of the coordinates.
Yeah,
it's the same that you can, it happens in the, for the diffeomorphism, you can see it as an active transformation. So you keep the coordinate the same and just change the fields or change the coordinates and the rescale the fields.
Okay, well, I guess you could add tau somehow to the phase space and conjugate it, and then you could write everything.
You can do it. Yeah, I think it should be doable.
Okay, yeah. Thanks.
But what happens is that if you take this information here, you put it into the action, so you obtain, I mean, the infinitesimal version of this transformation, and you calculate the nodal charges associated with the infinitesimal variation of the symmetry, you, of course, you will obtain this LM exactly by applying nodal theorem. So this is completely consistent with the fact that these are really the symmetries which are generated by this charge. So you could do the other way around. So in order to obtain the interpretation of the symmetry, we act on the initial condition instead of the numbers that parameterize our solution space, which, as I was saying, we have a four-dimensional phase space, so we need four integration constants in order to integrate the evolution, and these are choose to be the singularity and horizon location, which are given by these two coordinates t naught and t one, and we have the mass of the black hole and the fiducial scale L naught. So we have this also this fiducial scale, which plays a role in the first integral of motion. And all of them are rescaled by the Möbius transformation, which is given by this function f of time. And this means, I mean, two things. The first one is the fact that the mass is changed means that these are not residual diffeomorphism, because you know that if you have a Schwarzschild solution, a Schwarzschild black hole, and you act with a diffeomorphism on this line element, you just changing the way of looking at the same solution, so the physical content cannot change. And the mass is, of course, the physical content of a black hole. So by the fact that these symmetries change the physical content of the solution means that these are somehow physical symmetries and not residual gauge symmetries. On top of this, we also have the fiducial length, so the boundary, because of the need, I mean, we have introduced the fiducial length as the boundary of our three-dimensional slice, interplays with the symmetry. So this fiducial length is changed by the symmetry. So, yes?
Just a clarification question. I think I missed the definition of tau zero and tau one. Can you recall it?
Yeah, tau zero and tau one are the value for which we have, for tau one, we have, for tau naught, we have the singularity. So it means that, I mean, just a way of parameterizing the solution space. So if you go back and here we have that V naught.
Wait, I don't zero. I see the same slide.
On Shelley's tau square. Ah, you don't see the first slide now? Slide number four?
Yeah.
You see now slide number four or still the
first slide before?
Okay. So as I was saying, tau naught is the coordinate for which we have that V1 vanishes. So we have the singularity. Because on shell, this will be, tau minus tau naught square, if you want. So this is the metric coefficient in front of the spherical line element, and tau one is the coordinate for which we have the horizon. So V2 vanishes. So, sorry, not V2.
V2 or N? Sorry, I'm confused. Which one?
No. N is taken to be a one, because we have an extra degrees of freedom. I mean, we have an extra freedom in the parameterizing this tau, so N is taken to be one in order to have two dr du, and then this is just one minus.
So what is the definition of tau zero and tau one? That's all I'm asking.
The definition of tau zero and tau one is, I mean, just the coordinate for which we have the singularity and the
what horizon. Do you mean? So V zero, can you just state it? What is
it? Yeah, V one vanishes for tau equal to tau not V one vanishes, and for tau equal to tau one, I think this V two that vanishes. So it just I mean, they are just integration constant. So you can, I mean, tau naught is one, to, if one is the initial time, and tau one is just another coordinate, I mean, another number for which, if you have tau equal tau one, we have that, we are the horizon. So this answer your question.
Yeah, that was the question. Okay. Tau zero is the singularity, tau one is the horizon.
It's the horizon, yes. Harvey. Yes.
It was not, yeah, it was just a definition.
Okay, yes. Yes. So just to give to, I mean, picture of what happens is that we have, when we act with the symmetry, we change, we are mapping a solution into a different solution by rescaling, for example, the mass. Well, we also act on the boundary in the sense that we rescale the fiducial cell in the actually I call it time, but it's the null direction in which we look the window of which in which we look at the stationary black hole. And both are interesting feature in common with the asymptotic or boundary symmetries of the pool theory. The fact that we span the solution space by acting on with these physical symmetries, and the fact that the boundary, of course, plays a role in the game. Now, I've discussed mainly this SL2R part of the algebra, but there is some interesting thing to say also about this the Heisenberg part of the algebra, because we have that this Heisenberg algebra is parametrized by these four charges, which are like the position and the momenta of a two-dimensional particle. These are not the field V1, V2, and the momenta, which are not conserved. These X and P are all conserved quantities in the sense that they are conserved on shell. The derivative is zero. And the bracket of these four charges is proportional to a central element, so the identity, and times this parameter k, which I recall is the ratio between the infrared and the ultraviolet scale, because it's the ratio between the fiducial volume and the fundamental, I mean, the Planck length. And this happens for both cosmology and the black holes. And so what happens is that you have a central element, so a central charge, and we know that this central charge is in conformal theories, is related to the counting of degrees of freedom. So somehow it's interesting to see that this completely homogeneous and spherically symmetric models make appear a charge, a central charge, which measure the volume of our model, of our homogeneous space-time in Planck units. So somehow we have an information about the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory, which are expect to be Planckian cell. So this central charge actually counts the number of Planckian cells within our homogeneous model. This is something really interesting. And it's not the only way in which this central element appears, because it also appears by considering a generalization of this Möbius transformation into the Virasoro. I mean, if you generalize this SL2R algebra to the infinite dimensional Virasoro extension. And what happens here is that the equation of motion of V1 and V2 will transform as the quadjoint representation of Virasoro with a central extension, which is again given by a central charge which is proportional to this scale ratio. And I will just briefly discuss this a little bit more technically. So instead of taking an SL2R transformation, so a specific choice for the transformation of tau as a Möbius transformation, we generalize it into a general time, I mean, the general Pauli parametrization, and the way we generalize this conformal rescaling of V1 and V2 is by recognizing that this is the derivative of, 1 over C tau square is the derivative of the Möbius transformation. So the way we generalize this is by replacing with a derivative of it. And we act, if we act with this transformation on the action, we have that this action is valid, is the variation of the action is a total derivative and a bulk term, which vanishes only in the case of this transformation here. So we find that the only subset of transformation which are symmetry are these SL2R, but and even if this general transformation are not symmetries, what happens is that we can calculate how the equation of motion changes. So if we vary the action, we have the equation of motion imposed by V1, the equation of motion imposed by V2, and the symplectic potential. These are some functional of V1, V2, and their derivative. So we can use the transformation on the previous slide to calculate how this functional P and J transform. And what we found, what we find is that this P and J transform exactly as what's known to be the centrally extended conjoint representation with a central extension, which is proportional to this Schwarzian derivative, and the central charge, which is k times the Planck length. And this is, of course, consistent with the fact that the only symmetries, the only transformation which are symmetry, are the ones for which the Schwarzian derivative is zero, because the fact that p is zero is mapped into p equals zero is only true for vanishing the Schwarzian derivative. So
could you show again the transformation of the action? You went fast.
This is a transformation of the action. We have a total variation, which I don't put in because, this is what you expect for a symmetry. And we have a bulk term, which vanishes only for vanishing Schwarzian derivative. Anyhow, these extra pieces that appear, which is just linear in V2, can be also interpreted as an extra potential, which also appear in the case of a cosmological constant. So when you add the cosmological constant, you obtain lambda times V2, and this has been used to extend this construction of the symmetry in the case of a cosmological constant, because what you do is you switch on the cosmological constant by acting with a transformation which has a constant cocycle, then you do the SL2R transformation and then go back to the you switch off the cosmological constant, then you act with the transformation and then switch on again. So you can extend this this transformation to ADS and DS Schwarzschild black holes. This.
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah, can you go to the next slide? I have a question about that.
Yeah.
The next, where you have the algebra.
Yes.
Here, yeah. So if not you have algebra, a cosmological constant, you get a central charge for J2?
If I have a cosmological constant, I get the central charge for J2? This I'm not sure, but I think maybe yes. I'm not sure.
I mean, you expect in one case to get BMS, which is what you have here, and the other case to get, Virasoro, which.
So, yes.
Okay, you don't know.
No, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I should check. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay. So, I've described a little bit this hidden symmetries for the mini superspace setup, so for what we expect to be a background for a cosmological perturbation or for some perturbation of the black hole by some quasi-normal mode or some open radiation. So what we can wonder is if this background symmetry, so the symmetry for the mini superspace, do also play a role in the corresponding perturbation theory. And there are some hints for this to be true. Because we know that quasi-normal mode, I mean, there is a recurrence relation for the quasi-normal mode, which is have been obtained from NSL2R symmetry in the near horizon region. So the presence of this NSL2R group play a role in the symmetries of quasi-normal mode. And moreover, in a very recent work, it has been shown that the vanishing of the log numbers, so the response to the tidal response of a black hole for static perturbation, the vanishing of this log number is also related to NSL2R symmetry. So these are the two symmetries that I was mentioning, phenomenological symmetries that I was mentioning at the beginning. And for the second one, there is even a stronger relationship to what I presented here, because this vanishing of the log number comes from the transformation in the NSL2R group, which is associated to a special conformal transformation of the radius, which is exactly one, as you recall, tau was the radius for our transformation, and one of the Möbius transformation is a special conformal transformation of tau, which is the same that happens here. We have a special conformal transformation of the radius. However, the setup is really different, because in our case, we have some fields, which are the metric coefficients for the homogeneous background, which evolves in the radial direction, while in this vanishing of the log number symmetry, they had just the symmetry for the perturbation, so some scalar field, and they evaluate the symmetry for, I mean, the symmetry is realized as the transformation of the radius and the scalar field, which accounts for the perturbation, but this is done on a fixed background. So, I mean, there is still work to do in order to link these symmetries, this mean superspace symmetry and this perturbation symmetries, but there are some hints that this can be done. Yes, Laurent, you have a question? Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just that it's a little bit cryptic. It's I'm not sure what's the connection between. Yeah, is there a way you could explain a bit better what you mean by this connection with the Love number? How does the
vanishing of the log number,
NSL2R symmetry apply to perturbation? Because here you had a mini superspace. The Love number is about perturbation. So can
Of course. What
do you mean by the NSL2R symmetry implies the zero Love number?
No, the NSL2R symmetry that I'm discussing here the two here are not the NSL2R symmetry that I was discussing before. I was just saying that, I mean, for this, for example, for the vanishing of the log number, this NSL2R symmetry is a symmetry for the dynamics of the static perturbation. So we have a scalar field, which depends just on the radial direction, which is static perturbation. We have an equation for this, the propagation for the evolution of this scalar field. And this is,
so is this symmetry related to the one you're talking about, or
no? There is no. It's not
the conjecture.
It was a conjecture. A conjecture based on the fact that both the symmetries are related to a rescaling of the radius, which is this is special conformal formation of the radius. But this is just, I mean, a conjecture. I mean, just similarity between the two symmetries, which are obtained in a completely different setup. On one side, on the mean superspace that I was mentioning before, you just have homogeneous field which depend on radius. On the other one, you have still homogeneous field, but this is a perturbation of a fixed background. While on the other side, you have the. So what we should do is to do both at the same time. So study the dynamic of maybe, I don't know, I mean, superspace coupled to a scalar field, but I mean, this is not exactly what happens here, because what they do here is just the propagation of a test particle, so a perturbation in the sense that you have a scalar field propagating on a fixed background, while if you try to do both, you have mean, you have back reaction of the scalar field on the metric, so you're no longer sure that the symmetry exists. So I mean, this is something that should be done, but is still under investigation. Well, just to present some conjecture of the fact that this symmetry might play a role in the perturbation theory, because I mean, you have a background which is invariant under a set of transformation. You can imagine that field propagating on it should also be invariant under the set of transformation, if they are test fields and do not back react on the background. Does it answer your question? Or clarify a little bit what I was saying here?
Yeah.
Okay. So just to conclude this picture about mini superspace symmetries, I try to show that we have a general method to find these mini superspace symmetries, also with matter or without matter. We have applied it actually to black holes, to cosmology, and also to the Bianchi models, and we find that in many of the cases, the existence of these Schrödinger symmetries by a method which is related to this second geometrization interpretation, in which we trade the evolution of this of the study of the space-time metric by studying the Einstein equation for this metric into the movement of a particle on a field space parametrized by the metric coefficient themselves. And we also have some hints about some interesting role of the fiducial cell, because this fiducial length scale also play a role and interplays with the symmetry. And maybe we can imagine that this can also go beyond the mini superspaces, because I was mentioning some appearance of a central charge which measure what we expect to be the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory, measuring the number of Planck cell within our homogeneous model, and also maybe some conjectural relationship with scalar perturbation and quasi-normal mode. So in order to better understand the physical consequences of this Schrödinger symmetry, we can go back to one of the first slides when I was mentioning the fact that the Schrödinger group is also the group of symmetry of the compressible Navier-Stokes equation, because if we study now what is somehow an hydrodynamical model on this mini superspace field space, this could be related to some hydrodynamical regime of some analog gravity model, or the study of perturbation in some cosmological quantum gravity condensates, like what people do in group field theory. And we can also explore further the role of the fiducial cell by looking at this, the role of this central charge and the counting of the degrees of freedom. And a possible way of doing it is also to glue multiple homogeneous cell. And this can also be somehow a simple model to study the role of edge mode, because you can glue different homogeneous cell. You have that some charges which are associated to the fiducial length, so the volume, which is expected to be somehow how the cell talk into each other, to be between each other, and this is what is the edge mode for the full theory. And there might also be some relationship with the coarse graining by studying how the theory is changed by the rescaling of the fiducial volume. And finally, maybe then the last step would be to generalize this structure of the symmetry to midi superspace. So model which are still symmetry reduced model, but now become field theory. So we no longer have a mechanical model, but a field theory. And this will give some insights, for example, on rotating black holes, which can be realized by this midi superspace setup. and also on inhomogeneities in cosmology, and maybe at the end of the day, given also a connection with the full theory and the symmetries of the full theory. So thank you for your attention. And other questions are, of course, welcome.
Thank you very much, Francesco, for your talk. Before the faculty people in the room, I want to ask whether students have questions. If so, you can raise your hand. Okay, Nico, go for it.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe a naive question. Have you thought about interpreting the Möbius transformation you introduced in terms of some sort of stereographic projection?
Some sort of stereographic projection. No, I didn't try to. No, I didn't try to understand it like this. But more, and because if you look at the Möbius transformation, that's just like this, acting on the coordinate tau and on the fields, it's quite obscure. I mean, what this transformation does, apart from the fact that this is a rescaling of the coordinate and on the field, maybe you can realize it in terms of some stereographic projection of I don't know what, maybe some extra structure combining this field and coordinates. Maybe yes, so something that could be done and can give some interesting insights. But no, I didn't try to realize this transformation as a Möbius transformation, as a stereographic projection. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, go for it, Bianca.
Thanks for the nice talk, Francesco. You had some preserved charges. Can you give a kind of physical interpretation?
Of the charge?
Of the preserved charges, which I mean, had some quite in the beginning.
Yeah. Here.
Yeah. Okay, I mean Q0 I understand, but you have
Q0, also
the more involved ones, Q1, Q2, I don't know how many are there in overall.
No, just a finite set. Unfortunately we would like to build a tower of
but is it three or five or something? I mean it's a bit.
Sorry?
You have three conserved charges.
For each vector, you can build three. I mean, one is trivial, is Q0. Then you can build a first order charge for each Killing vector.
Okay.
And then you have a combination all the possible scalar products.
In your case of black hole, how many conformal.
The problem is that then there might be once you write them as phase function, actually what happens is that there might be, this is what happens in the case of black holes, there might be some combination, some scalar product of Xi, I, Xij that gives the same. I mean, for example, I can have Xi1, Xi2 equal Xi3, Xi4, for example. And that's what's happened. So it's not a trivial counting from the knowledge of the Killing vector to the number of independent charges that you found. So at the end of the day, we find eight charges, and I don't remember, maybe, I don't know, wait, how many vectors did we have?
Okay, but do they have a physical interpretation, or is it just some combination of mass and
it's just some combination. At the end of the day, it's just some once you write them, it's just a combination of these for initial condition, because you just have a four-dimensional phase space. Mm-hmm. So once you write the charge, you cannot, I mean, what you have is just four concept quantities. You don't have, and then if you have a sixth one, it just would be a combination of the four. So yes, a combination of this mass, this fiducia, this L naught, and then this tau naught delta one. So it's difficult also to give a physical interpretation, because the only physical, I mean, what you mean by, that's what you mean by physical, because if you just gave you this Marshall solution, you tell me that, I mean, the only physical quantity is the mass. But then if you look...
That's why I'm asking.
But then if you look at it from the point of view of a mechanical model and the symmetries, the dynamical symmetries of this mechanical model, you have some constant quantities, and you find that you have four integration constants. So all the four are physical, in the sense that the charge doesn't vanish. You have a symmetry transformation which is associated with each one of these. Of this initial condition. So in some sense, it seems that these quantities are promoted to be physical by the existence of this. It's somehow what happens also in the full theory. So you have some transformation which you expect to be diffeomorphism, but then you add the boundary and you recover and find out that the charge doesn't vanish anymore. So you say that, I mean, this is a physical symmetry, in the sense that it has a non-vanishing charge, so it maps solution into different solution, and so you give it a physical meaning by looking at the charge and the structure of the symmetry.
Okay, and at some point I understood that this was good to look into the quantization. Have you looked into that?
Yeah, I've looked into that. I didn't mention during the talk, but yeah, what you can do is just, because of the existence of this symmetry group, you have, I don't know where it is, the Schrodinger group, here, you have this set of observable. I mean, this Schrodinger algebra is composed by Dirac observable, in the sense that it's composed by constant quantities, and you can look into the representation theory of this group. Then you need to add some Casimir condition, because I mean we have an eight-dimensional algebra of observable for a four-dimensional phase space. So as I was saying just before, you will have a relationship between all the generators. So this is some Casimir condition on the algebra, and then you look into the irreducible representation of the algebra which correspond to the corresponding Casimir, and you have you obtain a quantum theory out of this without and just look into the representation theory of a group, and then you with a fixed number of Casimir, and then you obtain the quantum theory. And that's what I didn't do it for the Schrodinger group, because when I did it, we had a different parametrization of the symmetry, because we took a different combination of the charges. So we had a slightly different algebra, but then by imposing this Casimir condition, what you obtain is the same. And so yeah, you can obtain a quantum theory. And I found out that for this model here, if you just do the quantization, you obtain the same thing as doing the Wheeler-DeWitt quantization of the initial model. So you still have some singularity problem. And this is not enough to solve all the quantization issue. The problem is the fact that the model is too simple. In principle, it gives you a way of quantizing this mini superspace model, but I mean, it doesn't need to be true that the quantization of the mini superspace is a quantum black hole. You can have extra structure that play a role in the definition of a quantum black hole.
Okay, so you're saying in the end you get the same as if you would do standard quantization, you know?
Yeah.
Like
standard.
Okay.
Yeah, you get the same doing a standard quantization. Yeah, standard. I mean, we let the weight quantization by just promoting P1, P2 to integration operator and P1, P2 to the. I mean, just okay. Doing.
Maybe to continue with that, how many Casimirs do you have?
So four, I think.
Are they all continuous, or they become, or you have representation that are discrete?
I look at they are all. They're all vanishing actually, because what happens is that you have a four dimensional. So this whole algebra is realized on a four dimensional phase space. So all these charges just depend on V1, V2, P1, and P2, and tau. So. There are four relationship between these charges, which corresponds to the Casimir of the algebra.
And yes, which, what is the value of the Casimirs? A priori, the representation theory of this algebra is labeled by four numbers. And then what are the range of these numbers? Can they be discrete? And what is the spectra that the black corresponds
to? As I was saying, I didn't actually look into the Schrödinger algebra, because when I did the quantization, I was having a different parametrization of the symmetry algebra. So yeah, the SL2R coupled, it still had SL2R, but instead of having this, I had it acting semi-directly on an abelian, just the abelian part. A three-dimensional abelian part instead of one-dimensional.
I would expect generally what you say is the same, is like, you know, you're not going to get one representation, you're going to get a four parameter family.
Some of it
corresponds maybe to the
old one.
You're going to get new ones. I'm a bit surprised that you say it's just equivalent. Yeah. And then I would expect that some representations have discrete spectra, and then you need to understand the Planck-Schrell measure, or what is the black hole there. I would not expect it to be as simple as, unless you tell me there's only one representation, which is not the case, right? There's a four parameter family of representation. And you need to understand which one have continuous discrete spectra, what's the range of the Casimir.
No, but the Casimir, I mean, it depends what you mean by.
Well, I have an algebra SL2, so these are, you know, they're going to be, you told me there are four Casimirs, that's what I say. Okay, fine. Which means that the representation by four numbers, and then you can, I don't know, you have to tell me whether
non-compact. Yeah, but then the problem is that classically, this Casimir vanishes. So what you select one representation, you don't have a family of representation, just have one.
So you're saying all these Casimirs are zero, all these Casimirs are zero.
Yeah. So you fix the value of the Casimir to be zero. And then you have just one representation, so you don't have us.
And which one is it? The discrete? Do you get the discrete SL2R representation or the continuous?
Of SL2R, I get the continuous.
But okay.
No, for the SL2R, you have the discrete series. Sorry.
You get the discrete series, then you have discreteness.
Oh, yes, there is.
You will not get in Wheeler-DeWitt quantization.
No, sorry, I think you're talking about. You're talking about different things, you know, because Francesco says the Casimirs are fixed, but then it's inside the representation space you are looking anyway. So I know.
So if the Casimir SL2R is zero, then it's a discrete series. Whether the spectra are discrete or continuous,
It depends on the spectra of what? The spectra of for which operator? I mean, you can.
Yeah, it depends for which operator, exactly. Yeah. But then.
Yeah.
So yeah. Some operators have. Okay, which one have discrete spectra then?
So, for example, you get the mass as a continuous spectrum, for example, and not a discrete.
What about the volume and the excessive curvature?
What about the volume?
Well, in the end, there is only the mass, and then there's conjugated the tau. If I remember, there's a reduced phase space, yeah. It's just m and tau.
Yeah.
Really? Yes. I thought your charges was mch. That's the SL2R charges, right? I'm confused. The tau is the edge mode parameter. It's not the charge, right? Mm-hmm.
No,
the tau is not the charge. The tau is
not the charge.
It's the parameter which the charge acts.
Yeah.
So the charges
are.
Right. I mean, going back to the question of Bianca, there's eight charges, and if I understand, it contains a combination of mass, volume, and explicit curvature, plus maybe others.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And some have discrete spectra, but we don't know which one.
Yeah, I'm sure that the mass is a continuous spectra, and I'm not sure about the extrinsic curvature and the volume. Volume, I think, is continuous as well, but the extrinsic curvature might be discrete. I need to check this.
Yeah, but what I remember, what Francesco said, is that the values of the Casimir are valued. So also you have eight charges, you have a much smaller phase space, in particular the constrained phase space.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a paper by Kukash, and in the end, there's only the mass and the physically reduced phase space and conjugated to that time.
Okay.
And so that was kind of the reduced phase space. So there's not so much interesting thing to say anyway, which you say that lots of these Casimirs have fixed values.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But okay, so since there was some questions, so it seems also not completely yet clear what whether you get something different or not. Let's say that.
Thank you.
Maybe it's a good moment to wrap the official talk and we can continue chatting later with Francesco, I think. So let's thank Francesco again for his talk.